That's the way people are. We were curious about what's out there. Since humans emerged from caves or trees, we've looked at the stars. Our ancestors have looked at the stars and wondered what might be out there. Today I found some great images online, the artist rendering of what the craft, which has been called the Europa Clipper, might look like for the mission we've been discussing. It's still being designed and perfected, of course, but it's pretty exciting. Also, some animation from NASA of Europa itself. It starts an image of what the briny deep might look like, and then it rises through what appears to be miles of solid ice to the planet's harsh surface with massive Jupiter sort of in the background. It's great. It's inspirational, as is David Brown's book, The Mission. We will save time in this hour for you to ask some questions. Hope you'll keep it to the topic of NASA and missions and Europa, things of that sort. But we'll open it up in a bit, and we'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. David, I didn't realize until reading this book that Wernher von Braun had developed a plan to go to Mars, fairly detailed plan, way back when. I mean, before the Apollo missions even, that he had it sort of inked in as the ultimate destination. And that's important to your story because Mars is competition for the Europa mission.
That's right. Von Braun's his Mars project, as he called it, did precede NASA, and as he was one of the founders of, or one of the founding members of NASA, so to speak, certainly the father of the American space program, those Mars aspirations were basically wired into NASA's DNA. It's been chasing Mars ever since. As it relates to Europa, when NASA has a little bit of money and they can do something, the choices are, do we go to Mars or do we go to Europa? Well, one's easy to get to, and one's extraordinarily hard and expensive to get to. So Mars tends to come out on top.
And if we get to Mars, does that make Europa easier? Could that be a stepping point to a Europa mission, assuming that they had to compete with each other and we can't do both?
What's interesting right now is, since Europa Clipper is already approved and Mars 2020, now the Perseverance rover, that's going to be landing on Mars next month, we're in a situation where we're looking at what's next. What's going to be the next mission beyond these two? They're called flagships, these giant space missions. The Europa Clipper its wingspan is the length of a basketball court. These are enormous spacecraft. And one of the possible missions to come after Europa Clipper is a Europa lander that actually sets down on the surface and starts sawing into that ice and getting beneath the radiated surface. I think it has to go down 10 centimeters. And it can actually, it's basically as a microscope, and it's going to look for life, look for evidence of things that wiggle. Mars landing technology has a direct application to landing on Europa. So there is a synergy there. It's going to take some time for it to come to fruition, and certainly we don't know if a Europa lander is in the works, considering how long it took to get this Jupiter orbiter that encounters Europa multiple times, considering how long it took to get that flying, whether a lander is going to happen next is anybody's guess. But there is one helping the other. That's happening now, and that's an exciting thing.
Is it worth going if we don't land? Something that just circles the planet, takes pictures, or uses sensors to pick up data?
Absolutely. You really can't. One of the problems that the scientific community has expressed with about the lander is it's much easier to land on the surface if you actually know what it looks like. Europa Clipper is going to get enormously high-resolution images of the Europan surface, and that'll allow a lander to land with more precision. It's also going to characterize where life is most likely, and that's another important thing. If you're going to land a life-detecting instrument on another body, you ought to go where there's going to be life. If you were going to land something on Earth, you'd be better off landing in Central Park than you would landing in the Sahara Desert.
One of our listeners, our Coast listeners, is a guy named Corby Waste, and he posted some things tonight on Twitter. He was the artist who developed these images that we're posting on the Coast to Coast website for NASA about the Europa mission, what it looks like. And it's exciting to visualize it. I wonder if you can fill us in on the status of the mission. I know it's a green light for now. When it is scheduled to go off, I think 2023 was the earliest, and maybe 2025 is when it's realistically going to happen. But What are the chances of it actually going forward, and how risky is it that the budget might be cut or NASA changes its mind?
At this point, I would say it's 100% going to go forward. It would take it would be harder to stop it at this point than it would to actually launch it. In terms of its status, some parts are being built right now. It's going through what's called the critical design review, and this is the final engineering assessment of the integrated spacecraft itself, with all its instruments and checking what electromagnetic interference you get from different instruments and the spacecraft itself. Once it goes through the critical design review, they can really start sort of sparking blowtorches and building a spaceship. There are parts being built, though, like at APL, I was there a couple of months ago, and the wiring harness, the wiring being one of the critical spacecraft components, that's under construction right now. That's being built, and it's this incredible circulatory system of wires of different colors. It's quite stunning to look at. And in the months and years ahead, we're going to see big, giant parts come together.
In your book, we're introduced to all these characters who play key roles in the mission finally getting the green light. And it's almost like, as we mentioned before, it's almost like destiny, all these pieces that kind of fit together. And if any one had changed it, it would have changed the whole outcome. So there's one character, I'm trying to remember the name from your book. He's going to be a doctor. He's all set. He's going to be a physician. He's going to make a ton of money. He's going to save lives. And then he gets tickets to a lecture, and he's reluctant to even take it. This is a waste of my time. He goes, and it changes the entire path of his life.
That's right. That was Jonathan Lunin. He's presently at Cornell. He actually has the Carl Sagan chair, if I'm not mistaken. But he was another person whose life was touched by Carl Sagan. When he was a child, he grew up poor in New York City, and he saw in, I believe it was Scientific American, this article about this book by this astronomer called Carl Sagan, and it was about extraterrestrial life. And he was taken with the idea that a scholarly work could be written about this. He was just a kid, and his mom encouraged him to write Sagan. And he resisted, but he wanted to deep down, so he went ahead and wrote the letter. And sure enough, not only did Sagan write back, but sent scientific papers from the latest research, I think from Venus or Mars. I'm not sure I remember which one. But those sorts of chance interactions, or in this case, these sorts of caring interactions, right? Because this is, again, this is a deeply human endeavor. And those sorts of moments always tend to resonate in ways you wouldn't expect. In this case, it was shaping the future of space exploration.
I think maybe my favorite character in the whole drama, unexpectedly and surprisingly for me, is this Tea Party congressman from Texas who wants to be an astronaut growing up, can't do it for a variety of reasons that you can fill in, then becomes the ultimate champion of this particular program. Talk about him.
That's Congressman John Culberson, formerly a congressman from Houston. I believe he lost re-election in 2018. He was somebody that I didn't expect to fall in love with. I'm not necessarily totally aligned with him. And the more I talked to him, there was this childlike energy to him. He just loved space. And it's rare that you see that in politics, I think. You see what's politically expedient, but you don't often see what's deep down in somebody's heart manifest itself as policy, or manifest itself as law or budgets. And in Culberson's case, it absolutely did. He found a way through the budgeting process to basically force a mission to Europa through. And that sort of clever legislation absolutely worked. It absolutely paid off. And as he used to talk, he used to joke, NASA is the only mission that it's illegal for NASA not to fly. Or Europa Clipper is the only mission that it's illegal for NASA not to fly.
Well, he really went to the mattresses for this. He wasn't taking no for an answer. He went to war and made sure this happened.
That's right. And in the end, I think he probably lost re-election in part because some of his constituents thought he was spending more time worrying about space and not enough time worrying about Houston. I think that's probably an unfair assessment of his career. but it was certainly something that his political opponent threw at him, and he didn't win re-election. So obviously there must have been some merit there.
The only person that I know of the central characters in your book, The Mission, was Lori Garver. And I say I know her only in the sense that I met her. She came out to Bigelow Aerospace, I think more than once, but I met her there at one point where the NASA team came out and had glowing statements about what was going to happen with Bigelow's inflatable habitats. And then it didn't happen. But Bigelow, I spoke to him before tonight's program, and she's basically the only NASA muckety-muck with whom he had only positive things to say and felt that she was really solid. But you tell an interesting story in the book about her. At one point, she had a seat on a space mission herself.
That's right. This was one of the pioneering moments in commercial space. Russia was in the business. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russian space agency was in dire straits, which meant the United States was in dire straits, because when rocket scientists don't have enough work, they tend to freelance. And the sorts of people who hire rocket scientists to do freelance are usually enemies of the United States. So NASA had a vested interest in making sure the Russian space program stayed well employed. And that's one reason why we have the International Space Station today. But Russia has a robust launch industry. And for a long time, after the end of the shuttle, they launched astronauts, U.S. astronauts, to the International Space Station. And there was a launch that was going to happen to space, and it was going to be a celebrity was going to fly into space. And for whatever reason, that celebrity had to drop out. Maybe it was medical, maybe it was money.
Lance Bass, right?
Well, Lance Bass would come in later, weirdly
okay.
enough.
All right.
This was somebody else, and someone had to fill that seat. So the Lori's firm was responsible for filling that seat, and they couldn't find anybody. So they're like, Lori, why don't you do it? And she's this type A personality, and she's like, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. And so she went all in, getting sponsors from credit cards, getting sponsors from Disney or whatever, right? Lori Garver, you just flew to the International Space Station. What are you going to do next? I'm going to Disney World, right? And this went forward. She went through all the physicals. She spent months in Russia preparing for the launch. And then Lance Bass from NSYNC comes in and says, no, I want to do it. And she knew right away, she told me, there's no way this guy has his act together enough to get the kind of money necessary to fly on a rocket to space. In the end, of course, she was right. He didn't go to space. She didn't go to space either, because she had to give up the seat for him, because her firm was obviously responsible for putting somebody in space. In the end, that seat went to a box of cargo. So it's a bummer, but it almost happened.
Well, what was the price tag? It was like $20 million?
It was definitely in the eight-figure range. I can't recall the exact number offhand.
We were talking about programs that get started and canceled, and sometimes it's just a matter of chopping it to save money. The space shuttle, I mean, you know, maybe it was past its prime. There were problems, of course, and, you know, deadly problems that surfaced. But that program got canceled with no replacement, to the point where we had to rely on Russia for any of us Americans to get to the ISS, the space station that I guess we had plowed maybe $100 billion in, something like that. Can you discuss that decision, the lack of foresight, and how we were supposed to get to our investment?
That's one of the unfortunate realities of the space program. The space shuttle was getting on in age. Two-fifths of the shuttle fleet blew up, which is pretty grim numbers when you get right down to it. I don't think there's any other form of transportation where that had become that unreliable. The problem was NASA had not built a successor to it. It hadn't made much progress in it anyway. And to this day, if not for commercial space, SpaceX in this case, coming in and sort of rescuing the launch industry, or the human launch industry in the United States, we still wouldn't be able to do it. The Orion capsule, which is now designed, it's now being sold as a moon capsule, right? The Artemis program. That was originally designed to go to the International Space Station. And at some point, funding got cut, and they said, well, we're going to go back to the drawing board. So there's been more than one iteration of Orion. They just kept the same name. It's Orson Welles used to say, a story only has a happy ending if you stop telling it too early. And in this case, that's what it was looking like for the American space program. Could you even say we won the space race if in the end we're basically hiring Russia to be our Uber driver to the ISS? Thankfully, the story continued, and we found a way, and in this case, a glorious way with reusable rockets.
You know, you think about, we mentioned about Musk and his vision of getting to Mars, in fact, establishing a colony on Mars. I'm thinking about, you mentioned other billionaires, Jeff Bezos, and of course, Bigelow is a billionaire, not nearly as rich as those guys, but, you know, the precedent being exploring the new world. You know, you had rich people, sometimes royalty, becoming patrons of these early explorers, putting up the money, hoping for a big return. And it was all the difference in the world. I mean, the people putting up the dough funds those early expeditions that really do change the world. It's sort of like that with Musk and Bezos. They are funding their own projects, but it's the kind of thing that benefits space exploration and development all on its own. I know I'm rooting for Musk. I don't know how realistic his idea of getting within a couple of years people living on Mars, but I wanted to get your take on it.
That's a really good observation about patrons sponsoring explorers in this case, and I've heard that the age of space exploration that we're living in, called the New Age of Discovery. So there are these lovely historical resonances happening, or echoes occurring all around us. I think Elon Musk is probably over promising with respect to his timeline. But one of the interesting things about Musk is he may deliver a little late, but he does deliver. So I'm really interested to see what Starship, you know, what form that takes in the next couple of years. I think they have their first orbital launch this year or next year, and that's exciting because this is going to be a pretty giant rocket that they're developing. And I mean,
it's like the one that looks like it's from a 1950s sci-fi movie.
It absolutely does. It's dreamlike. It's science fiction. It's imaginative, and it's wonderful. And it's a thing that's real. It's a piece of hardware that you can put your hands on, what previously would have been a model filmed for a movie.
Well, it's pretty exciting. My impression is, you know, there's some things that Musk does not deliver, at least on the time he says he's going to deliver it. But the progress that he's made in a short period of time is astounding. I wouldn't put it past him. I mean, like we talked about before, those craft landing on a platform out in the ocean, who would have thought that would be possible? And, you know, yesterday he was here in Las Vegas. He's got the boring company that's boring a tunnel underneath the Las Vegas Strip for a transportation system. He's done it in an amazingly short period of time. I wouldn't put it past him.
What's interesting about the boring company is it has direct applications to Mars, because once you land people on Mars, it's still a pretty harsh environment. It's certainly not the kind of place you're going to walk around without a pretty hale and hearty spacesuit. So the Boring Company, the technology being developed now for the sorts of projects you just described can be applied to Mars, where people could live in a subterranean habitat much easier and much safer than they would on a surface habitat. So that's long-term planning, and it's if the Boring Company pays for itself with projects on Earth, and that technology can be applied directly to other worlds, and in this case, sort of synergistically with SpaceX, it's business brilliance. It's thrilling.
I don't know. Would you go? I mean, it's a one-way trip, presumably, right?
Yeah. It's would I go? I would like to be on the second flight.
Yeah, and I'd kind of like to maybe pop on back to the old home home turf one day. You know.
I would go there for a couple of months, but after that, I think it would get old quick. I was in an expedition to Antarctica while researching this book.
I'll tell you what. Hold that thought. We'll talk about it on the other side. We're talking with David W. Brown about his great new book called The Mission, about this mission to Europa. We'll open up the phone lines in a moment and see what's on your mind. We're going into our final segment of the evening. We're talking with David W. Brown, author of The Mission, which the part of the subtitle is in search of the second Garden of Eden at the bottom of an alien ocean inside of an ice world called Europa, a true story. It's a scientific adventure story, invigorating and a captivating tale of the people involved in this mission. When we come back, we'll go to the phone line, see what's on your mind. Our final segment of Coast to Coast AM coming up. All right, we're going to the phones to see what's on your minds. First-time caller Jason in Phoenix. Good morning, Jason. You're on with David Brown.
Good morning, George. And Mr. Brown, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you? Thank you.
I've definitely enjoyed listening. I actually find this discussion quite interesting. One of my high school buddies as a sophomore put together a report for our biology class. The professor was Dr. Munoz, and he, I think, is down in Mexico City now. But this was in West Covina, and I'm out in Phoenix now. But we put together a proposal on where we would send a spacecraft for the most likely chance of finding some sort of life within our solar system. And I find it interesting that we've sent things to Mars, you know, the different rovers from JPL out in La Cañada, and, you know, smart guys over there. They found after, you know, years that there's definitely microbial life. But as we know, celestial bodies, the closer you get to the core of that planet, the warmer it is, right? And Europa is an ice planet. So it seems like a drilling machine, you know, some kind of drone, some kind of robot, which is right up Musk and his different companies would be able to achieve, that would be a successful mission in finding life. And I'm just curious, how did you get involved with this project and so knowledgeable about it? Because I can definitely see why somebody would pick that body to explore further.
Those are really good questions. I'll answer both of them, or I'll address the first and then the second. The one way to get into that ocean, and this is the sort of thing that's far out, right? This is decades away. It takes a long time to develop this sort of technology, but it is the sort of thing that they're looking at right now. One way to possibly get into that ocean, or certainly into lakes inside of that ice, is using what's called a melt probe. So if you had some sort of radioactive element, the natural decay of it and the heat radiated from it could just naturally melt slowly into the ice and eventually fall into that water and send signals back. So that's one thing that they're looking at, and that's a real possibility. Who does that in the end? I don't know. I hope it does happen. As for how I got involved in it, I will say that when I first came to the project, like everybody else, I thought I had a pretty good grip on the space program. I thought I understood what was going on. And almost overnight, I realized I don't know anything, and what have I gotten myself into? But it worked out in the end, and that was a real advantage when I was writing this book, because as soon as I realized I didn't know anything, I was able to approach the project with a beginner's mind, and I let everything surprise me. I learned as though I'd never heard of NASA. And hopefully that reflects in the text of the book. And that's one reason why, if you're not a space expert, if you're not the sort of person who even knows what JPL is, you're going to enjoy this book, because it's written for someone who's never heard of it. It was written for my mom, right? She's not a space person. She doesn't know the difference between a black hole and the asteroid and an asteroid. So it's a very accessible book, and that was one of my goals, and I hope that I succeeded with that.
Thanks, Jason. You know, this could be a miniseries or a movie. It's pretty cool. I mean, it's a very human story about working so hard and surmounting different obstacles and finally making some progress. I want to ask you about this melt probe thing, the idea of having something radioactive that just melts its way through the ice to get down to, you said, lakes. So there are lakes that are at a more shallow depth rather than 60 miles to get down to the ocean?
Right. So the way the ice shell is believed to work is sort of like a lava lamp. At the surface, it's very cold, and then the deeper you get, like the last caller said, the warmer Europa gets, and certainly it's warm enough where it can sustain a liquid ocean. Because things get warm, warm things tend to rise. And so basically the ice shell convects. Water rises through the ice, eventually forming what it would amount to lakes in the ice itself. And the higher it gets, eventually it freezes and it goes back down and more lakes come up. This happens over the course of hundreds of millions of years, of course, or tens of millions of years, certainly. But one of the breakthrough findings for Europa were the discovery of plumes, these great geysers that are shooting, you know, hundreds of kilometers, or if not thousands of kilometers, into space. Certainly enough that the Hubble Space Telescope could spot them. So they have to be enormous, considering Europa's distance from the planet Earth. And the source of those geysers could be the ocean, but it's very likely that they are those lakes, which is great because those lakes come from that ocean water. It's a lot easier to get to, right? It's very difficult to get to go down into the water, but if the water is coming to you, all you have to do is fly a spacecraft through it, and you can sample it in various ways.
So I wonder, let's say you poke a hole through something really hot that gets through the ice, and you can access either a lake or the ocean, how quickly it refreezes. It's pretty cold there. I mean, I don't remember reading how cold it is, but I can imagine.
It's certainly cryospheric temperatures. I imagine it would be quite a challenge to create a hole of that magnitude. I'm not sure we could do it on Earth if we wanted to just yet. But the cool thing about space exploration is you get to use these. You have the greatest engineers in the world tackling the hardest problems in the world, and they're going to come up with some inventive solutions. So I think what it ultimately ends up being is going to be beyond our wildest imagination and way cooler.
Not just drop a nuclear bomb, as Elon Musk had suggested at one point about affecting Mars and making it more habitable. You know, we didn't even get into this, but the idea of radiation on board a ship, a craft of some kind, it creates all its own problems, political mostly. You had written about some project, a proposal for something, I think it's called GIMO or GMO, radioactive way to get a nuclear way to get to other planets, other faraway distances, and it just creeps people out on this planet.
Right. GMO was the Jupiter Icy Moons Orbiter, and it was supposed to be the first of a fleet of spacecraft that were powered by a small nuclear reactor. The reactor was about the size of a trash can, very tiny. And one of the problems that GMO ran into, or it was part of what was called Project Prometheus, one of the problems that it ran into was putting a nuclear reactor on top of a missile and launching it into space. If something goes wrong, retirees in Florida aren't really excited to see that happen. Now, GMO, if that reactor had crashed on Earth, it couldn't have caused Three Mile Island, even if NASA tried to. But notionally, it's a hard pill for a lot of people to swallow. I do think attitudes are changing. I think that as the Cold War sort of recedes in the collective memory of Americans and that threat of nuclear war begins to diminish, I think there's a greater willingness to go ahead and put these reactors into space, because once you do, you have infinite amounts of energy. I mean, that's the way you do it. Power is the king in exploration, as engineers say. Anything can go wrong on a spacecraft, but if power goes out, you're doomed. But if you have this infinite or this enormously efficient and powerful generator on your spacecraft, scientifically, there's nowhere you can't go and nothing you can't do.
West of the Rockies, Mitchell in Seattle. Hi, Mitchell. Good morning. Welcome to the program. You're talking with David Brown.
Well, thank you for taking my call, George, and Mr. Brown. My question was regarding colonization. Excuse me. I was thinking that it would be logical to build like a ring-type space station to test how the human physiology works at 0.4 gravities or 1/6 gravity like the moon. And I was wondering if that has ever been talked about in these circles, and if so, what could you tell us about it? Because I think that it would be logical to test human physiology or primate physiology in those different gravities before we start sending people all over creation.
You are exactly correct, and it is the sort of thing that I know, on paper at least, NASA's worked, has done work on. You can actually look, if you could just go to Google and type in old spacecraft design or old both spacecraft and space station designs, and what you'll see are exactly those sorts of spinning type habitats that would simulate. Sort of a weak gravity. That hasn't been implemented yet. I know that when NASA was doing the, what was called the Journey to Mars, this was in the early 2000s or late 2000s during the Obama administration, in the long term, to get astronauts to Mars, they looked at perhaps having a module of the craft that would fly astronauts there that would sort of spin in the middle. Because the idea is, once you land on somewhere like Mars, if your muscles have been atrophying over the course of the flight, astronauts would, you know, the spacecraft would land, astronauts would walk out and just collapse in their own weak, frail bodies. So that is a problem that's going to have to be overcome. It seems like the sort of, I say this as a writer, right? It seems trivial to me. I imagine it's enormously difficult, but it is something that they've thought about. So you're right on the money there.
Thanks, Mitchell. East of the Rockies, Mark in Baltimore. Good morning, Mark. Oh, Mark's gone. We're going to Carl in Boston. Carl, what's on your mind?
Hi. I was just wondering if they thought about intergalactic travel ever. If that's, I mean, I just heard you say that the muscles would be weak and the astronauts would not be able to sustain it. But has that even been a theory or a thought?
That's a good question. So intergalactic travel, probably outside of the foreseeable future, tens of generations from now, I don't know that we'll be able to leave the galaxy. But interstellar travel, in other words, going to another star, robotically at least, that's something that I know at the Applied Physics Laboratory, they are developing a spacecraft that could, within our lifetimes, in the next maybe 60 years, maybe at the very edge of my lifetime, but for younger people, certainly it's doable, a spacecraft that could reach another star. And that's an astounding idea. What would that look like? What would that solar system look like? What would that sun look like? These are things that were once the exclusive domain of science fiction, the sort of thing you would see in Star Trek, and now it's the sort of thing where they're designing spaceships to do it. I do hope that I live to see that, though I'm not optimistic on that number. I'm a little too old.
Thanks, Carl. Well, we do have two spacecraft that left our solar system, didn't they?
That's right. I believe there have been five that have left our solar system, but okay. Ones that are likely to hit other stars, the Voyager spacecraft, are going to do that. Now, whether they reach the star is an interesting question. Whether the cosmic background radiation or whatever other interstellar forces are sort of working on the physical frame of the spacecraft, whether it ends up sort of being eaten away or not, I don't know, and I'm not sure if engineers have quite worked that out. I've heard some people say, yeah, Voyager probably won't make it, and some people say, no, it will make it. But yes, we have left the solar system. We've left the influence of the sun, which is such an incredible achievement and something that, as a human race, we should pat ourselves on the back. Look at us, we did it. But expressly to explore another star, we haven't seen yet. But that is something that will happen.
Yeah, how to get the information back, assuming it even makes it. Isn't Voyager the one with the golden record, a couple of Chuck Berry tunes and descriptions
right.
of
and
humans?
That's another Carl Sagan project. So once again, you see his influence in the field of planetary science be felt.
In your book, The Mission, you mention about the Hubble, which is a great example of something that didn't go well in the beginning. And I had forgotten about the early problems with Hubble because it's been a success overall. They've made some adjustments, and we've learned so much, and the images are just unforgettable, the things that have been captured by it. But in the beginning, it was a mess that you, I can't remember what the jokes were, but some of the wisecracks at the time that described it.
Yeah, well, you're right. So when the Hubble Space Telescope first launched, to everyone's shock and horror, the images it was returning were blurry, which is very bad if you're launching a telescope. And some of the jokes that appeared on bumper stickers were, one that comes to mind was, if you can read this, you're not the Hubble Space Telescope. Interestingly, Hubble has sort of introduced a problem for NASA development that I think engineers are having a hard time shaking. And this is maybe me editorializing a little too much, but because Hubble has had such astounding success since its lenses were corrected, people have forgotten, like you just said, people forgot that it was ever blurry. People forgot that the Hubble Space Telescope was once a joke. And engineers kind of count on that. So with the James Webb Space Telescope, which is very over budget, very over schedule margin, people are kind of thinking, well, but once it launches, once it starts returning images, you're not going to remember that it was late. You're not going to remember that it was over budget. It's going to change everything. It's going to see into the earliest moments of time itself. So it remains to be seen. But, yeah, Hubble was an interesting problem, and it's one. It's a great achievement that it was overcome.
One other topic I want to cover, we got about 2 minutes left, two and a half, is about European partnership. So you describe in the early goings of the Europa mission, NASA realized that there is some value in bringing the Europeans in, that maybe we send two craft up there that they can split the cost with us. So describe that a little bit. And then is that still in effect? Are the Europeans going to be part of the Europa Clipper in any way?
Yes. So the European Space Agency is launching a spacecraft that's going to go to Ganymede, which is the largest moon in the Jovian system. And it will be there at the same time the Europa Clipper is circling Jupiter and encountering Europa. The cool thing about having two spacecraft at the same planetary system at the same time is that you get more than double your return. You actually get 2.5 or even three times the return because you can do synergistic science. So one spacecraft can take measurements from one vantage point, and one spacecraft can take images from or collect data from another vantage point, and the data can be corresponded and correlated, and you can get a greater science return. So that's happening, and that's going to be a game changer. Two spacecraft at Jupiter, who'd have thought?
Yeah, that doubled the information coming back, I would think, at least. David, thank you so much for being here. I think this is your first interview for this book, The Mission?
This is, yeah. So I apologize to listeners if I was a little nervous, but I'm so excited to talk about it.
And it's out now, or it comes out soon?
It comes out on Tuesday, so tomorrow morning, get it. You can go to bookstores and get it, or you could just order it online right now, and it'll be in on by the 26th. So.
Excellent! It's a great book. I hope people will check it out. It's if you like the space program and space adventure stories, it's certainly a great read. Thanks, David, for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Talk to you again whenever you got a new project. So you're always welcome here. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Robert Bigelow, and his BIX project. We have links if you want to check out that essay contest. You want to take a shot at the $950,000 in prize money that could come out. And thank you to my colleagues there at COAST, Michael Cosio and Donna Walker, our webmaster, Lex Lonehood, Dan Galati, and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday night with a trio of high-powered guests from the SCU. Good night, everyone.